Hello, I'm Barbara Hermanson. I'm calling our March 4th RAC meeting to order. We do have some people out today that we had several that had either out of the country or planning for the snowstorm at their work and so forth. But we do have a quorum, so we're going to continue. It was my objective to start immediately on time because I figure nobody wants to hang around here late any night, but especially not tonight, even though the snow isn't supposed to start until 5 o'clock. I checked. 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. Anyway, public comment period. Do we, James, have someone signed up for public comment?
Two individuals.
First individual is Barbara Melville.
Hi there, Barbara Melville, representing the National Capital Citizens with Low Vision. And some of you may not know, but we are the ones who, along with the AAC group, Patrick Sheehan, are spearheading the lighting initiative within the indoor rail stations here. And we're very, very excited. I'm sure you've used the indoor stations. You've seen the mezzanines, and they're certainly looking a lot brighter. We're happy, and I certainly hope you are as well about that. And we're hoping to continue on with the good work, and as they say, it takes a village, and I'm just here to say hello and thank you all. You guys have a lot of other things on your plate, I'm sure, as Barbara said, and I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for taking the time to serve, because it's very, very important that we as community members really have a stake in this and continue on with the good work, you know, with Metro. So if anybody has any questions, I did leave my email address on the sign-in sheet. So again, thank you, and I also thank you for your continued support and what we're doing.
Well, and thank you. We aren't accustomed to having lots of positive reinforcement, so we appreciate your being here.
Jeff Larimore.
For those of you who I haven't met, since I'm Jeff Larimore, I ride the Blue Line. I've talked about the Blue Line issues some over the past several months. And the justification that was given when WMATA cut Blue Line service last summer was that it was needed for the Orange and Silver Line because those lines couldn't handle the crowds. So despite the objections of Blue Line riders, they said nothing could be done. So when the RAC organized a meeting with us last fall, WMATA said that there just wasn't enough data yet to evaluate whether or not that decision was the right one. And so I'm coming tonight because that data is now available. Last month's vital signs contained ridership data through November, so it now has 4 months worth of data. And that data has demonstrated that there is one line that's standing out for overcrowding, and that line is the Blue Line, not the Orange and Silver. This is a graph of the ridership passengers per car since they started the Silver Line service. So the Silver Line is here at 78 passengers per car. Orange is 80. Blue Line is way above any other line at 102 passengers per car. So the Blue Line is clearly the outlier, even though Metro was because Metro was making the decision to cut their service. So since the justification for the 12-minute headways on the line was concerns about overcrowding Orange Silver, I think this strongly supports asking WMATA to revisit the headways and hopefully give the Blue Line back 1 to 2 trains per hour. So I'm coming to you today requesting your support and asking you to pass a resolution requesting that WMATA investigate restoring 1 or 2 trains per hour to the Blue Line. It would still have less frequent service than any other line of the system at 9 or 10 minutes per between cars. But this would be a major improvement for service to the Blue Line riders, and given that the data that has been coming out, I think that it shows it's clearly justified for Metro to revisit this issue again. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Jennifer, do you know, I know there's a report that we're, some analysis that was going to be presented to us at some point about the ridership. Do you know this, when on that is scheduled? Is that next month?
I believe that's the case, yes. It's supposed to be on your agenda for next month.
Right, okay, yeah. Thank you, Jeff. We know you've been a partner to us as we've dealt with the changes, so I appreciate your being here and reminding us of the numbers that we're dealing with. Anyone else? Thank you. Have the agenda before us. Any changes or adjustments to the agenda? Hearing none. We'll continue. I can never remember if I'm supposed to get a motion on that. Anybody remember? Do you know? You're Mr. Parliamentarian, are you? Oh, hearing none. Oh, may I have? Oh, how do I ask for that? Any objections? Oh, okay, unanimously approved. The past meeting minutes. I know we had a good suggestion from Marianne about not just mentioning that there were priorities for budget from last month, but she actually suggested that they be listed, which James is doing. But I don't know that that's I don't know if that's reflected in here though. It is already in here. Okay. Are there any further adjustments or changes to the minutes from the last meeting? Hearing none. Do I hear a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Noes? Abstentions? Thank you. Okay, as you know, we have Mark Downey, the new chair of the WMATA board, that's going to speak with us tonight. He is delayed a little bit, so we're going to rearrange our agenda. Same agenda, just different order. We're going to move to the committee reports. I'm first on that list. I believe the chair report from last month is in here. James, I think that's correct, isn't it? Yeah, it is in there. So, and I nothing really to talk about that. I would say that I did supplement that printed report with when I spoke with the board at the monthly board meeting, which was last Thursday. And mentioned that what our budget recommendations were, but we knew at that point that the budget going forward that's being proposed and we'll be have hearings on is for no fare increases, no service changes except for a very limited few that the Maryland delegation on the board actually recommended and wanted to have included. So that's really all I can say about my own report. I did share our priorities. The meetings that were held last Thursday, the committee meetings, were the WMATA Budget Committee, where they made, that was decided and that they forwarded to the board later in the day that there would be no fare increases, that they'll be looking elsewhere for funding. There's a lot of information on this on the website. If you want to look at last Thursday's meeting transactions, you can see all the details of what's in, what's out. There's lots of paperwork there if you're interested and haven't already seen it. The safety committee also met, and at the last meeting, the January meeting, they had made a list of 10 action items that safety action items as a follow-up to the incident in January, and they have made a lot of progress on many of those 10. They're totally on schedule to meet the deadlines that they had set for things that they're doing. That's also summarized or actually detailed out on the website if you're interested in that. Committee reports. Budget and Finance Committee. I know that Jeremiah is not able to come tonight. He's doing snow prep with Marriott, I believe. Is there anyone else here that is prepared to give a report from that committee? Okay. One of the things that did come up last Thursday is I had a chat with Mark from the finance department, and he asked if we were still thinking about working on fare simplification, it was something I think you, Fred, particularly were thinking about last year. And he said, if there's ever a time to put that together, it's in the next few months. And because in a few months, like by summer, I think they'll be working on the 17 budget. And that's the kind of thing that needs to really be thought out. And any suggestions or recommendations we have, get to them in the next few months. Any questions about that? Ryan, yeah.
I was just wondering if it might be possible. I've heard a lot about the fare simplification. Would it be possible to maybe have Fred or someone who's been involved in it just a 1 minute kind of looking forward, especially now if there's going to be a very short time frame on it? I just kind of was interested in hearing a little bit, you know, just even a minute.
Sure.
1 minute?
Okay. So I think last year we had a little, we talked a little bit about fare simplification. We did a survey for, to kind of look at like what kind of fare structures exist around the rest of the country. It's probably not all inclusive, but it looked at maybe 5 or 10 other similar type systems, you know, that are urban trains. And so what we found was we are somewhat special in the way our fare structure works. The more typical fare structures are not distance based, but more you pay just a flat fee to get on. I think that's probably what most people's experience is in other large cities. Pretty much everybody who rides regularly gets some kind of discount over the kind of like published fare. You know, so like you can buy, if you buy multiple tickets or passes, or then you get discounts. They have youth discounts, senior citizen discounts. All these are fairly common. And the size of the discounts, there's some similarity. There's some similarity between many of the systems. So there's just a question of, so as you know, our system is distance-based with a cap on the total distance. There's several things unique about the metro and its fare structure. So one is that we have this distance-based system, but it has a cap. So once you go so far, there's a max you pay, and then if you keep on riding, it doesn't get any more. So the other thing that's kind of unique is how people pay for metro. So the district, this area is unique because a lot of people get transport. So everybody can deduct their transit dollars, but not everybody has employer that will give them the transit fare. So it causes strange things in the demand. So some people, what they do is they'll ride until they use up their transit fare and then they'll drive. Whereas in other places, I don't think this is the case because they don't have like lots of people giving away free transit fares like they do here. So there is kind of a difference about how costs relate to demand. But in general, the metro is somewhat unique, and I'm sure if someone from metro came, they would say, well, no, there's other places like this. But in general, we are more unique on the distance-based fares. So if you look at, so to give you an idea, most fares are around $2 to $3. That's like the main fare at most places, remembering just about everybody gets a discount.
So, Fred, will you take that back to your team? I think I've also shared that with Jeremiah, but that request was coming. And, you know, consider, you know, if we're interested in doing it at any time in the future, that the time is in the next few months.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Bob's not here. Okay. You have the report, Lorraine? Okay.
check. Okay. We had our meeting on February 19th, and on that meeting, we decided there were a lot of issues that we wanted to discuss. Obviously, there's a limited time that we can work on these issues, so we decided to prioritize, and we came up with four areas that we wanted to discuss and prioritize them. The first one, obviously, is the safety and security, and within that, we put in the communications, what works, what doesn't, what Metro has right now, what works and what doesn't work, and we get suggestions. And we also discussed improving the announcements on planned and unplanned delays. We also mentioned the evacuation drills that are, if you got the email from James, you know that there's beginning to happen. So then the possibility of establishing a three-digit emergency phone number for Metro as 911, if we could Metro could have something similar just for Metro purposes alone, because if you dial 911, it will go to whatever jurisdiction you're in, and then they will then in turn call Metro because you're inside Metro. So that's how that works. So instead of cutting the middleman, if we could get a three-digit emergency number.
Lorraine, if I could interrupt, could you, in the interest of time, could you give us just what were the priority topics that your team selected to work on? You've already said one is safety.
Safety and security.
Right.
The other one was station operations issues, staffing, overcrowding, that kind of thing, escalators, bus stops, updating the maps and road schedules and signage, and the operations of the Metro sales offices that we have, with increasing the hours, et cetera, the listing of Giants and CVS stores, that kind of thing. Those are the four big issues that we have, and within that, obviously, the safety and security was the number one.
Thank you. And one thing that I'd planned to talk about tonight, even before Jeff showed up and started talking about the Blue Line, was that I realized just in the last few days we didn't have on our list the safety, the customer service team was the Blue Line response, the Blue Line follow-up, because that's clearly a customer service
thing.
Yeah,
that's an ongoing.
So we need to, that needs to be one of our focus items, too. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And the triple P.
Thanks, Barbara. I'll be brief. we looked at four topics of interest to us. One was the issue of cell phones on the Metro. Very curious as to how Metro looks at that going into the future. But since that is very much in tune with what the Customer Service Committee is talking about in terms of communications, where we've come up with a few questions. We'll pass them on to you guys, and especially since it's your priority, you know, you guys can take over for that. The other area that we're starting to work on is the area of priority seating for buses and Metro, and we're going to start that with a joint meeting with the AAC on the 16th. And then we'll see how to divide up responsibilities at that point. The other two areas that we'd identified just as areas of interest for us were, one, were interjurisdictional coordination with respect to bus operations, especially in the context of service cuts, making sure there's some coordination there. And then the other issue was mobile apps. We thought we were very curious as to what Metro's vision for mobile apps is going into the future. So those are the last two are the lesser priorities. Right now we're going to start working on the priority seating for buses and see what we can do with that jointly with the AAC. Thanks.
And thank you. Today in preparing for this meeting, I took a look at the email that I sent out a few days ago about committee expectations. And to my dismay, I couldn't read it. The formatting was all screwy. and I was the one that sent it. So that wasn't a good feeling. So I will make sure that we get that out to you in a probably a Word attachment or some other format, because it's really the administrative side of the committees. It doesn't address things like, yes, you know, come up with your ideas, take the ideas that the board has, and staff have given us, take your own ideas and go on them and build a plan and proceed. But it's more the administrative side of it, about holding the meetings and so forth. One of the things that also came up, we talked about an addition for the budget group with fair simplification, the addition for the blue line for the customer service. And one thing, Dan, when you and I were talking earlier, we didn't get to was we do have the new entire fair payment pilot starting. And this is probably not an immediate thing, but we definitely, I think in the past, expressed interest in being involved, and I'm sure the board wants us to be involved in terms of following it as the pilot progresses. It started just a week ago, week and a half ago. So I'm not sure what the timeline and the actual tasks would be on that, but I'm sure there's plenty for us to do. We're still on our committee topics. Any discussion about the committees? Let me go on to announcements. As I mentioned, the payment pilot did start on the 23rd of February, I think it was. I know that I am in the pilot and that Deborah, I think, is. Is there anyone else here that signed up to be a part of the pilot? I know there were some pretty stringent, it's only if you're going between these stations or these buses or what. Was there anybody else, though, that signed up? No one else here? Yeah. And Deborah, are you, in fact, participating already?
Yeah, but I saw one at Pentagon City Mall. It looks like it's not operated yet. Do I need to pass through the new staircase yet?
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, we had been encouraged, and I was hoping that we'd get a lot of feedback just by having, you know, many of us on it, but it didn't turn out that simple. So when we need to partner somehow with the people that are doing it to get input beyond what the two of us will find out. And the other announcement that Lorraine alluded to was that James had sent out notice about the evacuation drill in Maryland April 19th, I think? Yeah, at Greenbelt. I don't know what kind of response, James, I meant to ask you earlier. Have you had many RSVP yet? I know it's not due to RSVP. Yeah, okay. I think emergencies are something that we know it's important to get that right and how we handle them. So any of you that think you are interested in doing it and going, I highly recommend it. There's nothing like being there in person and seeing what's happening around you. So it's a long drive for me, but I think it'll be worth it. Are we still... Okay. Is Ron here? All right. Oh, I just didn't. Sure. Okay.
The April 19th drill that you're talking about, that's going to be out of Greenbelt. It's going to involve a few people. We're going to certainly invite people from the AAC committee, certainly from the RAC. We're inviting, I think, you guys, too, to come out there and participate in that. We'll probably be using some of the community emergency response team members in that exercise. And we're going to talk a little bit about that during our presentation, but... we try to do one full-scale exercise every year, and we involve multiple jurisdictions in that full-scale exercise. Last year we did Fairfax County. We'll talk a little bit about what we did with Fairfax County. But in this exercise series, Greenbelt is the chosen station for the April drill that we're going to be doing out there. And there'll be casualties on there. The fire department will come in, and they'll have to pull people off the train, and the train's not going to be at the station. It's going to be out on the tracks. And so if you haven't participated in something like that, I think that would be a great opportunity to see the jurisdictional response to that, to see the command and control and how that is all coordinated. So I think if you want to participate, that would be a great opportunity to see that.
Thank you. And while you, Mr. Downey, if he does still go first, then one of the things we'll plant with you is we know you're going to provide us with a whole host of information that's going to be good for us, but we're also looking for what, if you're looking for something specific from us, what is it? And you can tell us about that, what you'd like to, whether it's feedback or questions or specific issues or everything in general. Thanks. Oh, fine. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Thank you.
All right, good evening, everybody. I'm Ron Bodmer. I'm the Director of Emergency Management here at Metro. I've been here, I'm in my 35th year here at WMATA. And I was a police officer for 25 and a half years. I came back, and now I was working for the Office of Safety, and with the police department back home. Run of the Emergency Management Office here at Metro. Over my years with the authority, I've seen a whole lot. I've been involved in a lot of the exercises. I do have a training background. And kind of tonight's presentation is kind of walk you through kind of a story of how we do things here, especially with my office. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about evacuation strategies that we use here at Metro. I'll talk to you about some of the training that we've done and that we're preparing to do as we move forward. I'll talk to you about some of the different groups that we're involved in. I'll talk to you about the fire agreement that we have with the local jurisdictions and how that works. And then we'll answer any questions you might have. Okay, is that better? All right. First thing, our office was kind of started a few years ago, and I'll get to that. But we're basically a coordinating body, and we're trying to reach out to the first responders and coordinate some of the activities with the jurisdictions so they can stay prepared, and then when they get on the scene of an incident, we can coordinate the activities and make sure we have kind of all the pieces of the puzzle when we put this together. There's a couple ways that we do that. One of the ways is through preparedness. We do it through protection. We try to mitigate some of the problems that we have out there, and we have a big response and recovery effort. in the metro system, everything is based on time. The sooner we can recover from an incident, the better off we are. Our office staffs the Operations Control Center Monday through Friday during morning and PM rush. And I started that back in June of 2009. And the reason I did that is I saw a need to get into the control center and for early notification, because there's things that are going on that sometimes the staff in there get so caught up in moving trains, single tracking. We'll talk a little bit about that, whether it be a fire, whether it be it could be an accident, it could be a sick person on a train, that can really hurt the rush hours. We are putting a tremendous amount of service out there during rush hours, and with the addition of the Silver Line that we added last year, that puts even more trains out there on the line. And any little blip that we have in that, especially during our peak times, causes a whole lot of problems out there. So the sooner we get in there and clear it, the better off we are, and the better off you guys are too, because we can get you on your way. So back in 2008, that's when our office was established. We started off with about five people, and now we're up to almost 48. Under me at Metro, I have a operations division. They're pretty much responsible for responding to the incidents, and they do all the training. I have a planning and technical services group. I have what we call the digital video evidence unit, and they're the folks that watch the cameras. They download the video not only from the stations but from the buses and the other facilities that we have out there. And we have a few cameras on the trains. I will tell you this, our new 7000 series trains are all going to have cameras on them. So we're going to be able to see what's going on the trains here real, real soon. And I will tell you that we have a lot of strange things that happen on our trains at times. We do outreaches within the community. We're involved with our community emergency response teams that are in the region of the six major jurisdictions that we support. We train all the time. We do exercises all the time. We are the liaisons to the emergency management agencies in the region, mostly with HCMA here in the District of Columbia, because most of the events that happen in the region start in the district, and they just kind of go out from there. So we have a really good group. I have a very diverse group, and they come from all types of backgrounds. I have a lot of firefighters on board, and I have a lot of cops on board, too. So there's a police and fire background as well. So I'm pretty good about that. There we go. I can catch up with that. All right, NIMS. You all heard about NIMS, the National Incident Management System. NIMS is kind of a standard across the country, and it helps you manage incidents. That's basically what it's about. It's through FEMA, and we use the NIMS format here at Metro. Part of the NIMS format is a thing called ICS, which is the Incident Command System, and we're big on that. We know that the quicker we set up an incident command system, the quicker we can mitigate any incident that we have out there. A couple terms that you might hear in Metro is an on-scene commander. Metro designates somebody to be the on-scene commander to kind of coordinate the Metro operations of an incident. And that could be a train operator, it could be a rail supervisor, it could be a bus operator if it's a bus incident. But back in July of 2000, the transit police became the on-scene commanders. Chief McDivitt was our police chief at the time. Richard White was our general manager. And they said that the transit police would be better off kind of coordinating the Metro assets at the scene. So we've been doing that ever since then. There's also something that you hear a lot about is an incident commander. Well, what is an incident commander? An incident commander is usually not a non-WMATA person, but it's usually from the fire side. Could be from the police side, too, based on the incident. And they're the ones that actually run the incident. Most of the cases here at WMATA, the fire department is in charge of these incidents that we have, most of them. If it's an active shooter that we might have, the police would run that. But for the most part, it's the fire department that runs that. We have the OEM liaisons that kind of hook up with the incident command, and then we try to coordinate the activities and try to fill the pieces of the puzzle when we're trying to put this together. So we're kind of a coordinating body. one of the SOPs that we have is command and control and coordination of emergencies in the rail system. And this is in our Metro Rail Safeties and Procedures Handbook. And that tells us kind of how we run these incidents. It's applicable to all WMATA personnel, and it kind of mirrors what the fire department does in their command and control exercises. Denton Rourke just joined me. Denton's over there. Denton works with me. He's my operations manager. He's a former Prince George's County fire official that we brought on board, and Denton was a member of the COG Passenger Rail Safety Subcommittee, which was a subcommittee of the Fire Chiefs Committee here at Metro. And Denton's a friend of the family when he worked for Prince George's County Fire, and he's certainly a welcome addition on board.
Sorry, I'm late.
Yeah. Part of that agreement, that COG agreement, is a document here that we have. And this kind of dictates what the fire department does on Metro incidents. It's signed off by all the fire chiefs in the region and our general manager. And it talks about things such as incident notification, our fire rescue response, command and control. It talks about removal and restoration of third rail power, rail car movement and evacuation from the rail cars. It talks about release of information, who says what during a Metro incident. We have a hazardous materials section in there. And then we have a section there about our evacuation carts and some of our EMS cabinets. Now, outside, when you guys came in, you saw a couple of those carts that we had out there. That's some of the tools that are out in the system. And I think Denton will talk a little bit about that when we get into the presentation a little bit further. When you talk about some of the standard operating policies and procedures, Metro has established policies on a whole lot of things. This is just a little example of some of the procedures that we have. It kind of mirrors what was in that fire rescue agreement, emergency removal of third rail power. We talk about how to handle fire and smoke on the right-of-way or a roadway. We have SOPs on fire and smoke on the rail cars in the station. We talk about floods. We've had those. We talk about passenger evacuation from trains. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that. Train collisions, if it's out on the main line. The main line at Metro is pretty much where you guys ride back and forth on. But also we have some of the issues in our rail yards where we store the trains and park them at night. We get our share of bomb threats. We get our share of suspicious packages. We get our share of unattended packages here at Metro. It talks about coordination of an emergency in a common corridor. If you hear a common corridor at Metro, what do you think that means when we have that? What is our common corridor, do you think? Anybody know offhand? If you hear that, that's pretty much just where we have either a rail line or a highway that runs adjacent to the Metro right-of-way. That's kind of what that is. And we have had incidents where trains have come through on the rail side onto our property, and we have had many incidents where vehicles have come through our fence line in our common corridors. And we have a special little device that we have on the fence lines out there. It's called an intrusion detection warning system. And whenever anything breaches the fence or tips the pole a little bit more, I think it was 15 degrees or so, it sends us a little alarm and doesn't allow trains to go up in that area. And certainly hazardous materials incident, we don't have a whole lot of those, but I will tell you this, that we are sampling air 24/7 around this place. Okay. All right. Let me talk to you about types of evacuations that we have in the system. For the most part, all of you are riders, I'm sure, on our trains. What do we try to do when a train has an issue? What do we try to do with the train if it's between stations or at the station? The train's having mechanical issues or some other type of problem. Communicate with the passengers, and there's a term that we use here at Metro called offload. We offload the train, where they tell you pretty much to get off, and the train goes out of service. If the train is having problems in between stations, which we have a few of those, what do we try to do with that train? We try to get that train to the nearest station we offload that train and take it out of service, and wait, and you guys just wait for the next train. Now, during our peak times, you don't have to wait too long for a train. They're pretty much stacked up waiting to come in there. But we always try to get you back to a station if we can. When we can't get you to a station, on that particular train, there's a couple ways that we can come get you. This particular evacuation protocol here, this is when a train is just outside the station platform limits. It's not quite to the station, but we can't move it. So we'll bring another train in, get as close to it as we can, and we'll actually walk you from the bad train to the good train onto the station platform through a couple doors that will open up on that train that's partially in the station. That's called our close-in evacuation method. So that's one way we do it. We don't use that too often. The next one, which is the recovery train, this is pretty much what we use all the time. So a recovery train is nothing more than a train that could have people on it or it may not have people on it, depending on where this train is. But if you're on a train that we can't move for whatever reason on its own, we'll send it in a recovery train, and we'll actually couple up to that bad train. We will leave you on that train because we may have passengers on the recovery train. Sometimes we'll offload the recovery train, and then we'll either push or pull you back to a station. And that's pretty much how we do that. We will offload both trains, take both those trains out of service, and then let you guys catch the next train that's coming into the station. And that's something that we do quite often here. Another way that we do it is a rescue train. A rescue train is brought in when, again, we can't move the train. It's between stations. The rescue train is offloaded of all passengers except for the train operator, and we will come as close to the incident train as possible without coupling up to it, and then we're going to transfer you from the bad train onto the good train, and then we'll take the good train back to a station platform and either offload you or single track around the incident train, which will just go around it. And that's another popular option that we have. All right, this is the last resort. I can't tell you how important this is. The last thing we want to do is put you guys on our tracks. That's the last thing we want to do. Okay, it's really, really got to be a dire emergency to do that. Have any of you guys ever been on our tracks, either above ground or underground? Okay, well, if you participate in the April 19th drill, you'll get a good sense for what it is. This will be above ground, but you get a good sense for what it's like out there. It's not a pleasant environment. It's difficult to walk on sometimes. In our tunnel section, we'll talk a little bit about that. It can be dark. There's some obstructions, some tripping hazards that are out there. It's just really an unfamiliar territory for people that don't work for Metro, especially on the rail side. But basically, the two pictures here, the surface track where you see the tracks above ground there on the left bottom, we would take, if we have to take you off the train, we're going to put you against that fence on the right-hand side. And we're going to keep you there and walk you to the nearest gate that we can access and get you out of there if we have to do that. If you're on a bridge, an aerial structure that we have a safety walk that generally is in the middle of the aerial structure, but it could be on the side too, depending on where you're at. And we would put you off onto that safety walk and get you to an area of safety as well. If you're in our tunnel, I will tell you this: we have signage on the trains. And if we do have to get you into a tunnel evacuation, which side of the train do you go to in the tunnel? Have you read the signs on the center doors that talk about evacuation? Which side of the tunnel to go to? No. Which side? Yeah. Huh? Side with lights. You look at the tunnel, the side with the lights on it is the side where the safety walk is. The dark side of the tunnel is where the third rail is, and I don't think you guys want to step down on the third rail. I don't think that would be good. So you always look in the tunnel for the side where the lights are, and that's the side that you would go off on if you have to. But again, that's a last resort. It switches back and forth. You'll notice when you ride the trains, look at that next time. Look out the windows when you're in the tunnels, and you'll see how the lights change from side to side when you're riding down the tracks. Okay, but it's always the side where the lights are is where the safety walk is. Okay? because the third rail switches from side to side in there. Now, typically, on our trains, do you know which center doors or which doors of the train are the emergency doors to get off the train when you ride the train? Which ones, do you know? They're all numbered, all the trains in it. When you get out there, you got to look at these doors and see how they're numbered. All right, there's 3 and 10, doors 3 and 10. They're the ones that have the passenger-initiated evacuation device on the doors. They're clearly labeled. We have 12 side doors on the trains, and we try to put you we try to use the center doors for one reason. At the other doors, the front and rear of each car is where the collector shoes are. And we don't want you stepping off a train car onto a collector shoe, because that's what picks up the electricity off the third rail, and that's not good to do that. So that's why we try to go to the center doors to if we have to remove you people off that. There's also another way we can do it, the front or rear of the train. Now, those doors are usually kept locked. We have a key. We have keys to open those doors up. The fire service has keys to open those doors up, and that's another way we can get you off a train, front or rear. And we have ladders on these trains, emergency ladders, that we can walk you off these trains down onto the tracks, then we can get you up on the safety walk from there. So there's a couple ways that we can do that. But again, I want you, that is the last resort. The safest place for you guys to be is stay on that train, if at all possible, because we'll come get you. We haven't left anybody yet. We will come get you. Trust me. Sometimes it may take us a little while, but we will come get you. So the safest place to be is on that train, unless something's on that train where the train is not safe to be on. Okay. Some of the tools. I'll let Denton talk about some of the tools. Denton, if you would.
Good evening, everyone. Again, I apologize for being a little late. Some of the tools, we're just going to talk briefly about some of the tools that first responders use, and that's your jurisdictional fire departments. You probably know Metro runs through 6 major jurisdictions. We deal with all 6 of those fire departments, along with some federal fire departments and some other assets. Well, NIH is still federal, military fire departments, things of that nature. A couple of the main tools they use are the E-Tech carts, which you're doing good. They're located in every station. You can see them in the platform. They're in large silver cabinets with a red sticker on it that says ETEC, which is E-Tech. And as you can see in the photo, it's just a person-powered cart that runs on the rails, and the emergency responders use this to move equipment down to an incident scene, and then they use it to evacuate either injured or non-ambulatory passengers. And they push it back and forth, so it's all people-powered. Like I said, they have to work a little harder going uphill, and they have to keep it more under control going downhill. So it does have some challenges. The next slide is what we call a second-generation E-Tech cart, although we call it a MERV cart, and as you all know, as the Ridership Advisory Council, everything in WMATA has a 4-letter acronym, so we stick with that, of course. And a MERV is a motorized emergency reconnaissance vehicle. It does the same job, except they're battery-powered. So the emergency responder can actually ride. They put this together, located in cabinets, so they put it together, takes them a few minutes, and then they drive it down to the incident scene. So this one is a little easier on them. They can arrive fresher, and then they can also use that to remove non-ambulatory or injured persons that they've packaged up on the scene. So those are a couple of the main tools that they use that are located in stations. Yeah, so that, the MERV carts were purchased through an Urban Area Security Initiative grant. This is actually an idea that came from London after the London bombings in 2005. National Capital Region sent a group of emergency responders and Metro folks over there to see what worked well for them, tools and things that they might have, and this is one of the tools that they really raved about. And so over a period of 2 or 3 years, all of us as taxpayers, we supported this project and brought these tools in for use in our system. Now, fortunately, we haven't, other than exercises, they have not been used on an actual incident yet. I look at that as a good thing. Hopefully, they'll stay in their cabinets all the time, unless we're training with them. You're a little out of stuff there. We do try to, in all of our drills and exercises that we do with emergency responders, we try and include folks from the accessibility community. This is really twofold. It helps, number one, really helps the emergency responders in getting a better feel for assisting folks with mobility issues or sight impaired, hearing impaired, whatever it may be. We always get a lot of really good response from the fire service because they don't always get an opportunity to interact with with this community. And it also serves well for the community to see how the emergency responders, how the fire services works with them, how they do triage, how they categorize things. And anybody in a mobility device, that's really, you know, that's an extension of themselves, of their body. So they're very, you know, they want to stay with that, and it doesn't always work out like that. So it's important that the fire department get an opportunity to explain to folks how triage works and how they determine who needs to go when in life-threatening situations. And we also work really hard in reuniting anybody with a mobility device. That's really something that Metro is working hard on in that area. A couple other things real briefly. We have emergency response maps. All the emergency responders have them. All Metro emergency responders have them. Transit police are in the kiosks. These are detailed drawings of the system, all the access points, fire protection features, all that sort of stuff. So they're very critical for the fire service to use. We also have underground, you've probably seen these as well, in similar silver cabinets that the ETEC is on, as our EMS cabinets, and they're marked with a star life. That's a blue star life on a white background. You can see those in the underground stations as well. And those carry, they have light sticks in them. They have pre-packaged bandages and some a packaging device called a SCED, which is basically a plastic about a 6-foot-long plastic device that the fire service can package a patient in and move them out. And those were also, all this EMS equipment was purchased through UASI funds, so that was also a UASI project. The idea being in a serious incident where there are a lot of walking wounded, the emergency responder can grab someone who is capable of assisting and give them this bag of bandages and then have them assist other walking wounded that have, you know, cuts and more minor injuries. So we want to touch briefly on some of our training efforts that we do with emergency responders. And again, this includes all of the jurisdictional fire departments. If you live in Montgomery or Prince George's, and in some of the Northern Virginia departments that are volunteer and career combined departments, we work with, we train volunteers and career folks. We try to touch everybody. We work with the jurisdictions to do that. We train Metro employees and local police departments. Now, as you know, Metro has we have our own police department, but it can't be everywhere at all times. All your local police departments are out there enforcing the laws and chasing the ne'er-do-wells, and they sometimes come in contact with our system, so we like to protect them. So we teach them how to protect themselves in the Metro. We don't want them chasing a shoplifter down in the tunnel and putting themselves in there with the third rail power and most importantly, the moving trains. So we work hard with all of our emergency responders. We do a myriad of training with all of them. One of the slides will show you, this is a 5-year total of training that we have done with emergency responders. Now, a lot of your fire departments especially, they'll do a lot of training on their own, and that's not captured here. So if you look at a number and think, well, it's a little low, this only counts for training that we do with them. We do train the trainer where we give them some subject matter experts within their own departments so they can do some in-house training when they're out doing on calls and stations and things of that nature.
To our training family is Loudoun County Fire. Loudoun County knows that the second phase of the Silver Line is coming their way, so they're coming to our Landover facility all the way from Loudoun County, and they're in our Ellis, our lab, where they're doing some escalator and elevator familiarization training there. But Loudoun County will be joining us here real soon on that. Some of the previous exercises that we did, this was back in 2010. We did a 3-exercise series. We had a bus explosion, we had a rail yard collision, and we had a explosion underneath the Potomac River between Foggy Bottom and Roslyn. And that, again, was all part of a UASI grant that Arlington County administered, the fire department administered for that. And that was a good chance for us to practice. We used the MERV carts, I think, on that. That was the first time that we used them back in 2010. Here more recently, we spoke about this earlier, the Silver Line that opened up last year. We did two full-scale exercises out of the Silver Line. We did a tabletop exercise with a fire in the little tunnel section that we have out there, which I thought was very good. And we did our active shooter exercise. It's the second one that we've done of the active shooter. We did one up at Friendship Heights a couple years back, and then we did this one out on the Silver Line. And it was good to see the jurisdictional police departments working together as well, and the fire departments also. And I think we trained, what, over 800 folks up there when we do that training series.
Ron?
Yeah.
Can I ask you just a quick question?
Sure.
I was just wondering, is it anybody's job or is it a collective job to think of further scenarios or further things that could happen on the metro system? You know, I know you have a long list of things, but, you know, the bad guys are always coming up with something new to try to do. I was just wondering if it's anybody's job to, you know, read books or look at what's happening somewhere else to just get an idea of other things that could possibly happen.
Sure, and that's a great question. Absolutely, that goes on all the time. Both within our Office of Emergency Management, you know, one of the things we're known for, not everybody likes it, but we're always looking at the worst case scenario. Well, to us, they're like, well, that you know, they're like, the risk of that won't happen. Well, we say it will happen, so, you know, we have to be prepared for that. But as you know, we're part of the Transit Police, and they participate in all of the intelligence gathering and sharing that goes on. Each of the major state-level jurisdictions all have what they call a fusion center, and these are folks that are from different organizations that get together, and they track all the intelligence that goes on. A lot of it is public access stuff, but they spend the time to put it all together, and they also have the contacts to get more information on certain things. So one thing we really do is we look and see what they're doing worldwide, because we look at if it's happening somewhere else in the world, it's going to come here eventually to the United States. You know, worldwide transportation systems are one of the number one targets for terrorists or revolutionaries or whatever you call them, wherever they are. Bus systems, especially in Asia and the Middle East, the bus systems are constantly under attack. Commuter rail, there, you know, so many people packed into a tight little place. So we look at all what they're doing there. We look at how they're doing it, the methods that they're using. And we try to keep up with all the latest and greatest terrorist ideas that, you know, are made available to us. Yeah. And we do that also in conjunction with our local jurisdictions. They come to us sometimes and say, well, you think about this, you thought about that. Firemen and firefighters and police officers kind of think that way. So we do have a lot of that brainstorming going on, but that's an excellent question.
Yeah, part of the Silverline exercise series that we did was we put what we call an EOD component in it, where we put suspicious packages on the train after we cleared the active shooter, and we also put in a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device. So the bomb squads from not only Fairfax County, we used Virginia State, I believe, and also the Transit Police, the bomb squad, all had some play in that exercise. So we cleared out all the active shooter part of it, and then we let the bomb squads go to work. And I will tell you this, that they have people that make bombs or devices that challenge them as far as trying to make them safe, you know, and using all the equipment that they have, the X-ray equipment that they have, the robots that they have, to try to clear that is difficult for them. And it's rare when they can practice that in a subway environment. So we wanted to put that as part of that Silverline exercise. So you may see some more of that because they don't get to play much in the metro on that. Let's see. Some of the plans that we do, we certainly have a lot of emergency operations plans. We have EOC manuals. We have a pandemic flu right now. Tomorrow and tonight we'll be instituting, I guess, our severe weather plan that we have with a little bit of snow that's going to be coming in here tomorrow. We've used that quite a bit. And something new that we've done, and I think it's going to benefit the region, is we got some jurisdictional monies to come up with station, what we call emergency response station evacuation plans. We call them EREPs. And we picked three as a pilot. We picked one in Virginia, one in the district, and one in Maryland. And since we started that, we've completed 25 of these maps, and we got funding to continue to finish up with the remaining 66 stations that we have. And this is the first time, really, with the maps. Denton talked about the emergency response maps, the fire maps that the firefighters have. This is a map that the jurisdictions are going to have also, and the firefighters and the police officers, the emergency responders. And this is a very detailed map of not only the station layout, where all the emergency exits are, where all the special equipment is, but it's also going to tell where the staging areas are, topside, where emergency bus shuttles are going to be, where command posts possibly could be set up based on the incident, and then the inner workings of the jurisdictional support that we're going to need in. So if we do have to close down a section of the rail, similar to a track shutdown that we have for the maintenance side of the house, it'll tell us where the bus shuttles will be set up, you know, what buses we're going to, you know, kind of what we're going to need, what are the different players from the region that we need to bring into the mix for the coordination piece of that. One of the things, we talked about this Monday night, with the Accessibility Committee, is the new Silver Line. That's pretty much the bus side of that's run by Fairfax County. Metro has very little to do with the bus service out there. So if we get into a situation where we have to bypass the stations and we have to set up a bus shuttle, we'll be using Fairfax Connector buses, and that's kind of, I think, the first time that we've done that. But we have a memorandum of agreement with them that we'll be using them. Command and control, the same thing like we normally do, but now we're using a different group to do that. So I think you're going to find that these EREPs that we have, these plans, will really help the jurisdictions when we have it instead of the metro station. So I'm pretty happy about that. And that's just talking about the EREP station characteristics, ICS organization, and things like that. And we're going to finish up with some of the next steps. I don't want to get on Mr. Downey's the presentation, but I will tell you about some of the training initiatives that we have. Our deputy general manager here at Metro has asked us to do, quarterly full-scale exercises. We talked about earlier, we have really one that we were required to do each year, but now we're going to be doing four for the next 3 years. So 12 exercises that will be out there, full-scale exercises on our mainline tracks, and that's unheard of. We've never done that really before. A lot of times in the old days, we used to have to do the drills in the middle of the night when we had the track time, but these will be done during revenue hours with other trains running out there, and we're gonna do it like it's real, like the real thing, and that's certainly going to be challenging for us, but I think it's also going to help the jurisdictions too when they come in here and respond to that, and we're looking forward to that. So that April 19th, I believe, is the first one that we're going to do on that out there at Greenbelt. Yeah. So that's our kind of our presentation. If you got any questions for us,
we will give a round of questions, but you don't get off the hook yet for not telling us yet if you're looking for something specific from us.
Okay, then they're going to be participating in the Greenbelt exercise. One of the things that you guys can help us with, we learned Monday night that some of our hearing impaired folks, when there is an emergency on the train, the firefighters come and they flash lights in their eyes, and it really confuses them. You know, so as you guys are regular riders here with Metro, we'd like to reach out to you. What would you like to see us do better? Out there in the system. We have a tremendous amount of resources that are coming to assist you, both internally with the Metro staff, but also externally with local fire and police. Okay, one of the things that we ask certainly is if we have to pull you off a train, if we have to put you in a tunnel, we want to make that as orderly as possible. One of the things that sometimes we find when people self-evacuate off a train, okay, that is a true emergency for us because they can go anywhere, and we have to shut everything down when that happens. And we've had that happen. That's happened at Anacostia incident a couple of years ago, and we had people going every which way down there. So sometimes, folks, when somebody thinks they know what they're doing, they pop a door and they go out the door. A lot of folks follow them, and that may not be the best thing to do. sometimes because once you get into that environment, that unfamiliar environment, okay, there's other things that, certainly can happen to you down there. We, you know, a 22-inch safety walk, we have a lot of tripping hazards, we have obstructions that stick out from walls in the tunnel. You know, it's wet, it can be slippery down there. And if you're not familiar with that, okay, that can add to some of the chaos that we can experience sometimes early on in these incidents. So what we try to do on a regular basis is we'd like you to, try to stay calm. When we get trains that are stalled between stations and we can't move them, we're sending assets and we're actually staging assets on either side of you. Not to make a deployment necessarily, but we're staging people. So if we got to come in there and, get you, we have people in place to do that. And we do that pretty quickly early on in, the incidents. We don't want to commit our resources to the track bed if we don't have to. We'd rather ride a train up to you. But our idea is to get support staff to you guys on the train because the train operator is overwhelmed. You know, they're trying to make announcements. They're trying to figure out what's wrong with the train, and it's very difficult for them. So getting support staff on these trains, especially during our peak periods, is crucial for us because you've been on these trains, and they can be wall-to-wall people sometimes. And getting people up there to help with that process, to kind of let you guys know, communicate with you guys with what the plan is, you know, moving forward is crucial to us. So we'd like you to try to stay as calm as you can for sure on these things, okay? And then with the exercises, just being part of a passenger on a train and learning that, you know what I mean, seeing what to do when, we're coming to get you and, pull you off a train, because if you haven't done that, which I imagine a lot of you, has anybody ever been pulled off a train before and put on their tracks in here? Okay, that'll be an eye-opening experience for you. On that. So that's what I asked. And then with you guys, what do you guys want to see us do? Just like when you talked about, you know, the drills, you know, what kind of drills we do, challenging ourselves, what would you like to see us do for some of these exercises? What experiences would you have? Is there better ways for us to communicate with you? You know what I mean? That's kind of the information that we would look out for you guys to tell us. And we'll incorporate that in the exercises. We'll do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, we're going to do a quick round for those of you that have your signs up. And if you could limit it to one question, the most burning question you have, because I'm sure we have an opportunity to give you some follow-up questions as well, which James will, as always, wonderfully coordinate the receipt of those, and I probably will delegate to the customer committee to do any recap if we need to. But okay, so I'm going to just go around this way. Dan?
Oh, that was the last one
that had mine up. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, you know, we're notorious for missing the people right next to us.
I don't know if this is a question or just an observation. You know, the system is getting more and more crowded. And, you know, the aspect of any incident that has to do with crowd control, especially the psychology of crowd control, I think is going to become more and more important. You know, there may be a time in which functionally the Metro has a certain amount of capacity, but then, you know, maybe from a safety point of view, you shouldn't be at that capacity because if something happens, you can't get people out or people will get pushed onto the track. So I was just wondering how you guys look at that. You know, it's hard to do drills with this because it entails, you know, a lot of people in the Metro stations.
Well, I will tell you this. We get a lot of practice with the crowd control here at Metro because that's what we do. We move people around. You know, the inauguration in 09 was probably our busiest time ever. You know, we moved, I think, 1.4 million people that day, and we've never done that before. But we did it with I think we only had one really incident where we had somebody fall on the tracks, and we cleared that pretty quickly on that. But this city is known for special events. We're dealing with the crowd management all the time. You know, every weekend down here, there's something going on where we're dealing with crowds and malls, you know, packed with people. So we're kind of used to that now. Our regular commuters, what I call our savvy commuters, they pretty much know what to do. But when we have a lot of visitors here in the city, you know, they're coming in to look around and stuff like that. Sometimes they're just looking around like, what? This is beautiful. You know, for a lot of our commuters, they're saying, you're standing in my spot because my escalator is right there when I get off this train door and stuff. But it is challenging for us. And I'll tell you, with all the service that we're putting out there, it's very critical that we move a problem out of the way so we can do that. When we run into crowded platforms and we can't move people on trains, we go to that infamous term of bus shuttle. system. The buses can't handle the crowds that we have in these stations, and it's a ripple effect that we have all over the place. And now we are sending assets not only to the incident scene, but also we're sending them to some of our more crowded stations, transfer stations like Metro Center, Gallery Place. We'll send them to Roslyn. If we know we're at Farragut West and it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon, guess what? We know that the crowd's coming up there for that. So we try to send the assets to that to help with that crowd control. And you'll see the cops out there with bullhorns. You'll see the station managers out there with bullhorns.
I'm concerned about, like, it's one thing having a lot of people on the Metro for a normal event, you know, like, but even if it's a lot of people, it's another thing if there's an element of panic. So my hope is that the people that are going to those places have, you know, there's some study of, you know, what do you tell people, you know, because once a panic starts, it can get really bad.
Right. I think that's the big thing with the Metro staff is the customer communication piece. I think our media folks do an excellent job as far as getting the message out that we have delays on the line, you know, talking, you know, with our kiosk screens, with the passenger information display system we have on the platforms, getting out to the media outlets, you know, through Twitter and Facebook or whatever. But the customer communication, sometimes that can be a challenge for us. And getting people there to do that and getting the right message to the folks is key for us. Okay.
Ryan.
I guess kind of following along on that, I do a lot of work with TfL in London. It's part of my job, actually. And one of the things I've noticed that I think WMATA tends to be lacking on is kind of the simplistic safety branding. I didn't know before tonight that we always look for which side has the lights, and I didn't know that door 3 and door 10 are the ones you're supposed to exit from, and I would consider us to probably be some of your most savvy commuters, and if most of us didn't know that, I think the messaging gets lost. I know the big panel that's right by the center doors, but that's not going to be something that someone stops and goes, the car's filling with smoke, let me go ahead and spend a couple minutes and read this. I think making sure that even if it's something that people can look at for 2 seconds and sort of know which way they should go, and something that kind of continuously reminds people, hey, you know, look for the lights if you're having to evacuate in a tunnel, is something that I haven't really seen a lot of, and I just was hoping that that might be something you guys look at moving forwards, this kind of simplistic safety messaging that's both in stations and on the trains to kind of constantly have people sort of thinking along those lines.
Yeah, we had, I think after our Anacostia incident, we had other incidents where people took it upon themselves to self-evacuate off those trains when they really didn't have to. And that's something we don't want people doing. So we didn't want to really promote that, you know what I mean? We want to keep you on the rail car if at all possible. And I got you with the smoke on the train. That's a different scenario there. But for the most part, we want you to stay on there and not go off the trains. And if we do have to take you off the trains, we want that under direction of a Metro employee, either the train operator or the rail people when they get up there, the cops when they get up there and stuff like that. We'd rather keep you there. Okay.
Okay. Go ahead, Marianne.
One more question sort of along the same line. Given that we have old cars now and communication on trains is mixed at best, to keep people from self-evacuating, but I didn't hear in these exercises, what is the communication piece that you practice with the patrons, not with yourselves? Because that seems to be a question that needs some help in terms of keeping us from going off the train.
Yeah, for me, I'm big on the boots on the ground type of scenario. With the train operator sometimes getting overwhelmed, you know, with what's going on, you know, with trying to fix the problem on their train, you know, trying to get the message out to the customers that are on the train, I'm big on getting assets up there to help them out. And that's what we try to push to do, to get somebody on that train that can give you the message, that can tell you everything's okay, everything's going to be good, and the resources are coming your way to do that. When we don't have that communication, then you guys get antsy, you know what I mean, because you don't know what's going on. And you're right, some of the older rail cars, when we hook them in our conscious out there, they don't communicate well. And those 1,000 series cars are on their last leg, and we can't wait for those new 7,000s to get out there on the tracks. But that is an issue, and knowing that, that's why it's critical to get people up there to help out with that message to you guys.
And I think if whoever participates on the 19th, that would be some excellent feedback. Because a lot of times our drill players could be their police recruits, or their CERT members, but if people are some sort of exposure, a police recruit just does what he's told. A CERT member has some training. So I think folks, that would be an excellent thing for a group like this to look at if you're there on the 19th. And we'll certainly make a note to include that and make sure they do a good job on the 19th.
Yeah, in line with what Marianne raised, again, communication, we know all these issues with the cars. I was wondering if it's possible to raise this as a security issue, right? Not just a, you know, normal communication, but the same way that you invest in equipment, right? Invest in that equipment in the cars. I mean, if we're going to wait for the 7,000, 8,000, 20,000 cars to be out, it's going to be a long time. And to add to that, it's the lack of mobile communications in the tunnels. I mean, you know, it's available in many cities. I don't see why it cannot be available in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Kind of a bigger picture question based on the presentation that y'all gave. How much of your focus on emergency management preparedness is looking at terrorism or bad guy things, and how much of it is looking at what happens when the train breaks? It seems that I'm not dismissing the amount of havoc that a guy with a terrible idea can wreak, but it seems that most of the issues that WMATA and many other systems have had have been because of the system itself has failed, not because somebody has attacked it.
And you're exactly right. Most of the time, it's either a mechanical issue that's going on. It could be a brake issue on the train. It could be a door problem. That's usually the most instance that we run. It could be something as simple as a sick person on a train that we can't move during a peak period of time. We got a single track around that. But I think when we go into these things, we go into an all-hazard approach because you handle pretty much them the same way as our response coming to these things. So it's all incident dependent, you know, what's going on. But you're exactly right. Most of the time, it's an internal, usually a mechanical issue or something like that. There could be a little fire on the tracks or something that we gotta deal with. We rarely have anything like a bomb going off, or we just don't have that. You know, we don't have hazardous chemicals being released out there. We just don't have that. We have these little incipient fires that we might have out there, little smoke issues that we might have there, or we have some malfunctions with the trains or the escalators break or something like that. That's usually what we have for the most part. But when we come, it's coming. We try to come the same way each time when we do that. Approach it the same way.
As part of the communications issue, you know, to keep the riders informed of what is happening if you're stuck in a train or what have you, you have to take into consideration that Washington, D.C. is an international city, and we have a lot of guests. And I just wanted to know if you take into consideration having on staff people that speak other languages so that they can help communicate the issues with other passengers. Because if those people are the ones that get hysterical or what have you, that with one person hysterical, that can create a mountain. So.
Yeah, I think sometimes I can't tell you that we have a very I guess good response as far as multilingual people, you know, that are on these response teams that are coming out there. We may have some, but realistically, I think we would depend on customers to help us with communication. If somebody can talk in the same language to explain to people, you know, kind of what's going on, it's very very difficult for us to do that. And we look to you guys to help calm people down, that may be experiencing that. And I will tell you this: we may not be able to get to you right away. So you may be in a situation like that for a little while before we can get to you, depending on where you are. Out there. Now, I think the jurisdictions, you know, they may have some bilingual folks that are part of that, but I couldn't give you any numbers or anything like that as far as what your response is.
Bilingual brochures.
Yeah.
Those are available. We just don't have the announcement for that.
Right. On that, yeah. So that's challenging for us, yes.
I would say the same thing that Lorraine said. Now, how would you have a procedure or do you have someone look at the EMS, a firefighter, a policeman, who knows some signs that could be put on during special emergency incidents? You might want to think about find someone who is equipped with the American Sign Language. That's all. I'm just an idea.
Right, and I think some of our police officers do know sign language, but not a whole lot of them, and there's no guarantee that they would be working that day where they would be responding to that call. So I think some of the EMS providers that we have from the fireside might have the same skill set, but we never know. It's all incident dependent. We never know who might be responding to these calls. But I think when we learned this, I think the Monday night was the fact that we're reaching out to you as far as what are your needs from us. If there's a problem with you, you know, kind of understanding, tell us if you can or write it down and let us know that because a lot of times people just get very, very excited. We learned Monday night that sometimes the service animals that they have can get excited too, especially in a chaotic scene, you know, that some of the folks have out there. And some of our folks that are mobility challenged, they can only be moved certain ways, and they need to tell us, the firefighters, how to do that. You see some of the devices out there, there's a little yellow, what we call a stair chair, that's out there, and that's something that the fire service uses to transfer somebody from their mobility device into that to get them sometimes off the train or down a set of stairs, and then we reunite them there. But how do we move you? You know, I mean, it's difficult sometimes, so we depend on you guys to kind of let us know too on that.
So I'm curious about one thing. So what's the difference between an incident and something like the station is so crowded nobody can move? I mean, it seems to me, what triggers what you call an incident?
Well, an incident can be a whole lot of things.
But you know what I mean? There's days where things happen, and it seems like a near bad thing to be on the platform because nobody can move, and those don't seem to be incidents. So what in your mind triggers that? Oh, now this bad thing is an incident.
Yeah, we will get calls from the train operators that are coming into a station of crowded platforms. I will tell you of an incident that we had at over in Arlington. Where we had a person that put themselves in front of a train, got hit by a train up at Clarendon, and the time of day that it happened was around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And while we were able to single track pretty good around the incident at Clarendon, the businesses at Roslyn were emptying for the evening rush hour, and Roslyn became a major crowd control factor where we had almost what a mass casualty incident up there because the station was so crowded. So trying to watch the system, trying to watch the cameras, you know, the surveillance of the cameras, looking for that, listening to the train operators, the reports out, the station managers reports out of what's going on in their stations, kind of dictates, you know, how we're going to be coming in there. And if we need to stop entering into the station, we will be sending resources to do just that until we clear it out.
But are the station managers actively trained to deal with this? Because I think a lot of people that ride think they're not.
I can't speak for what kind of crowd management training that the station managers go through, but they're in the stations every day. They all have portable radios, you know, that they can communicate with the control center now. They used to just have the phones. Now they all have portable radios, and they're used quite a bit for problems that go on in the stations to go down to the platforms and check that and report that. But it's very difficult if you have a station that just has one kiosk, you only have one station manager. If you go to a transfer station like Metro Center, you have four kiosks there at Metro Center, so you have a little bit more eyes on what's going on there. But it's very difficult, and I'll tell you, during our peak periods, we can have crowd issues within minutes, you know, especially when we have so many trains out on the line.
And I think we do we say incident, that could be the genesis of something, kind of like to what Catherine was talking about. Now, just in the short time I've been with Metro, if there's a switch problem early in the morning, we start to deploy assets to that early on, because we know what's going to happen. We know that if something happens at point A, we know where the stations are going to be. And that is a seriously crowded platform. It is an incident in and of itself, because that can be certainly, if we only so many people fit in there, and if we keep pushing them in and no trains come through, or no trains that can take more passengers come through, then that's a problem. And that's where we'll send transit police. I mean, that's their major goal, and the station manager and the rail operators. But there's only so many cops and rail people out there. So it takes some time to get them there. Your rail supervisors are on the train with you. That's how they get around. So if the train's not moving, then they're not moving. Half the transit police officers are also riding the trains. Hopefully you see them out there, because they're riding the trains as well. So it can take them a while. But we do, when we say incident, I mean, we're thinking of crowds as a serious issue. And like Ron said, we get intel from train operators. They do call in quite a bit and say the train is, you know, the platform is crowded, slow down. And then we try to get assets there to help to manage that. You know, generally people don't get unruly per se, but we like to keep a presence there to help keep the crowds in check, but mainly to meter. You know, we don't close down the station, but we'll meter the entrance. We'll hold people up until a train can come and create some room on the platform.
Gentlemen, we really appreciate your being here. It's been very informative. I'm sure we'll come up with some more questions and feedback for you. So thank you very much for being
Ron
here.
It's Ron R. Bodmer at WMATA.com.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much. And for those of you on the rack again, just questions, comments to James. Mr. Downey, I am sorry to keep you waiting. It's a bad thing to keep the chairman of the board waiting, I imagine. Yeah. Thank you. No problem. We just rearranged things. No problem. Mr.
Yeah.
Is that the one, James, that you think is the bad one, or do you want to? You're okay? Okay.
Okay, I just asked if we could go around quickly. I can see your names, but I wanted to associate a jurisdiction with them.
Okay. I am Karen Lynch, and I'm representing Prince George's County, Maryland.
Thank you.
Will White, Prince George's County.
Thank you.
Pablo Estefan, Sisi.
Mary Ann Zimmerman, Montgomery County.
Montgomery.
Mm-hmm. Ryan Alty, Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
Dan Turk, D.C.
Barbara Hermanson, Barbara. Alexandria. Alexandria.
Yes.
Fred Walker, Fairfax.
Debbie Titus, Fairfax County.
Thank you, Deborah.
Deb McKenzie, Arlington County.
Lorraine Silva, Arlington County.
Ben Shaw, at large, but from D.C.
Stephanie Beecham, D.C.
All right, you break the phone. Thank you, Catherine. And I'm Mort Downey, Fairfax County, but a federal appointee to the Metro Board. Finishing up now my fifth year on the board and my first month as chairman. I've done more damage in my first month than I did in five consecutive years. I am very busy. I hope we're making progress. But I really want to thank all of you for what you do as members of the committee, really helping us, giving us information we need. I know you're giving up your time for no compensation. I can relate to that. I know that, as Ron was talking about earlier, sometimes we work in a hostile environment. I can relate to that as well. I don't think this is one. But we really do value what you're doing and want to keep in touch with you. I think of myself as a transit rider, just like you. I have been riding public transit for 75 years, from the time when my mother used to take me on the streetcar down to the Department of department store in downtown Springfield. I have been a regular Metro rider for the last 20 plus years. When I moved back from New York, we located near the end of the Orange Line, and I've commuted on the Orange Line for 22 years. Many, many years on the New York City MTA. There isn't much that could happen on a transit system that hasn't happened to me. So you're representing me as well as everybody else. I had a good meeting this morning with the senior leadership. We had tried to get it scheduled a couple of times, and it got snowed out. But I had the chance to kind of meet with them, sit across the table, give them some ideas of what I was expecting. I just boiled it down this minute to five C's. Number one, customer. That's who we work for. That's who we really have to be responsive to. Community. It's the communities of this region who really support us, and we have to think what their objectives are and how we support those. Communication with both the customer and the communities and among ourselves and with us on the board, we've got to have open communications. One of the things I really believe in is the theory of no surprises. We really want to be advance noticed on things that are going on so that we can communicate them. I also strongly advise them that I believe totally in compliance. It's not just doing the right thing, it's doing the right thing in the right way. We have lots of federal, state, and local codes and agreements and provisos, everything from small business procurement to the way we submit our grants to the ADA requirements. All of those are requirements, and I don't consider them burdensome. I consider them what we have to do, and I just wanted to get the message across that complying with those and being sure that the board can have the insight into what's being done is an important thing to me. I said that being a federal member of the board, I do not want Therese McMillan to call up another time and say, you screwed up again. We've had that call before. I don't want to have it again. And then lastly, confidence. That's what I really wanted to say to the senior leadership. I have confidence in what they're doing. I support what they're doing. I want to know what they're doing, but they are professional at what they do, and they do work hard. And on the whole, we get decent results, some days better than others. We're working out of some problems. I've been over the last 3 or 4 years, I had the opportunity as a member of the executive committee to meet regularly with the RAC leadership. That's been very helpful to us. We will continue that process of the members of the executive committee sitting down with the leadership on a quarterly basis, kind of planning out what the work programs are, what are the things that we're interested in, what are the things that you all are interested in. I think we can arrive at a meeting of the minds, but what has been really helpful in the last 4 years is to identify a few things to be done really well that would be used and useful in terms of influencing us on policy and being the sounding board for what we need to know from the users of the system. It's not our system, it's your system, and we really need to hear from you. And with that, I'll quiet down and answer any questions I can possibly answer.
Wow, I don't think we were expecting that. I'm sure we can come up with a lot of questions. One thing I'd like to start with is that, you know, because it's early in our year too, yes, not quite as early as it is for you, but we formed our committees. We're putting together our lists of priorities that are typically, as you mentioned, some of them are things that we really are excited or care about, and some of them are the things that we've been asked by either the board or the staff to take a look at and give some feedback. So we're just in the process of doing that and trying to figure out where they belong and who's going to do what. And
When you have that agenda, we will be very anxious to see.
Yeah, well, I'm really hoping. Well, yeah, because our quarterly meeting with the leadership team, which is, mm-hmm, you know, Dan and Fred and I and Bob, who you know, Bob Fogel.
Bob's an old friend.
Yeah, I know that. The four of us, and then anyone else who's available too, but the four of us especially will be with you later this month. This is our first quarterly
And I was very pleased last Thursday that we took off the agenda the need to be dealing with fare increases and service cuts. So we really have a more positive relationship, at least for a year.
I think you'd find unanimous agreement on that.
Yeah.
So
I heard today the rest of the service cuts that were left on the agenda are coming off. So there will be hearings that will not have a substantial content to them, but we still have to have them.
Right. So I open up the questions.
Yeah.
I'm going to go around this way this time, although I don't see a lot of things in the air. So
yeah, come on.
Fred come gets the first questions. Chance, not the last chance this time.
So first, I am very excited to hear the first C is customer, because so I don't want to sound negative, but often when we see presentations from the staff, customer service will be on the slide, but it's almost always the last bullet instead of the first bullet. And though people say that doesn't mean anything, I think it actually means a lot. And so I hope that knowing that it's the first bullet will make a big difference.
The first bullet actually is safety, but I couldn't figure out how to get a C out of that. But customer comes right after that.
But the second thing I wanted to ask, or maybe, so we just had a great presentation, but one of the questions I've had ever since I've been on the RAC, and I've never had an opportunity to ask the question, which is, so what, it's never been my impression, I know that safety is important, but to me there's like indicators that maybe safety isn't the highest priority to the Metro, and here's my example. I've been riding the Orange Line for about 12 years, and there's construction debris in the roadbed that's been there for 12 years. And to me, nothing good happens with trash in the roadbed. And why is it that no one ever notices this but me?
I don't know. I notice it sometimes. And I know that two indicators of a safe and well-run system are the debris is off the roadway, and if you go in the shops, you could eat off the shop floor. You really have to, make that a priority. So the next time I'm out on the road with somebody, I will look for that. Tell me where it is, and I will. Yeah, I'll look for it tomorrow. Not tomorrow. I won't be riding tomorrow. Yeah, I will do that. Yeah.
Deborah,
you're on.
Again, I want to say I agree with Fred that safely is a port. Security, not security, safely is a port. I have a question. If you have heard anybody mention that some riders have walked through the middle of the door, on the train, on the car, where there are workers or staff supposed to use, I've noticed some riders have walked through the middle of the car. So I wonder if anybody has reported to you, because that's a safety issue.
It absolutely
some
is.
Some young people were playing, walk through the middle of the car. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you ever heard about that.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
My question is more in operations. I guess where are we on the search for a full-time general manager?
Somebody would ask that. I don't know. I mean, I do know, but I can't say where we are. I will say what I said to the staff this morning. You might think it's easy to get from point A to point B. Rich Charles takes his departure, and point B is we hire a new general manager. Life is never all that simple. We've got a new mayor, got a new governor of Maryland. We've got a large number of new board members. All those shoes haven't fallen yet. There's still some more to come in. It's like a set of gears. We've got to get them all meshed and pointed in the same direction. When we're there, we'll be able to move ahead. In the meantime, as I said, in terms of confidence, I have real confidence in Jack Requa, keeping the place going well. We've talked with Jack this morning about some initiatives that he wants to undertake, and I certainly endorsed his doing that. it's more important we get the right person than we get somebody quickly, but we're not there yet. And I told the Post today, who wanted all the inside story, I said, the next time I talk to you about this, I'll have the name of the general manager. I won't tell you when that is, but that's when I'm going to talk to you again. Yes, ma'am.
One of the questions that has come up with one of the committees is, given that every jurisdiction has real budget problems, how does WMATA sort of, I know you've got people from all the jurisdictions,
yes,
but
we certainly do.
How at a, I guess, probably a working level, do decisions get made so that the customer does as well as the customer can?
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the interesting features of WMATA governance. Four representatives from each of the four three jurisdictions in the federal government, two voters, two non-voters. Any one of those jurisdictions could band together and vote no on something and kill it. That very, very rarely happens, but it's kind of what's in the background. And those members have a divided loyalty. They're Metro board members. They're here to do a good job of governance on Metro. They're here to deal with the customers and all of the things we want to achieve. They are also either delegates from, or in some cases, elected officials on the other side. So, you know, when Kathy Hudgens from Fairfax sits at the table and says, we need to do more, we need to do more, she also knows she has to go back to Fairfax and say, and it'll cost you more. And will her colleagues on that board do that? Same thing with Maryland. In Maryland, basically, the Maryland DOT writes the checks, and they're watching out for that. So it's a real process of serious negotiation to get to a conclusion. We can't print money. We have no dedicated source of tax revenue. Having such is not necessarily a great thing to have. When I worked in New York, we had all kinds of dedicated taxes, and we still would have problems and shortfalls we'd have to negotiate. But this year's effort on the budget is a good example of that. We knew it's a tough year for us, but we also know it's a tough year for the whole region. Combination of federal shutdowns, sequester hitting contractors and the like, everybody's hurting. And we just had to, you know, grit our teeth and say, how do we work with the jurisdictions to get to a level that they could accept, that we could feel we were doing the right thing? Rich Charles came in December with a preferred budget. It didn't pass muster with the jurisdictions. They just said, we hear you, but we cannot afford it. And we've just been back and forth. Up till now, last Thursday, we finally got their concurrence that lowering our ask in terms of the residual subsidy, which is what they make up with, to a particular number would work for them. And then we have to figure out how it works for us. And we came up with some ways to pay for that. But it's a, it is an iterative process. It'd be nice to be at a time when everything is growing. It was nice for people who were on the board for many years when ridership was growing and new rail lines were opening up, revenues were good. I think some of the jurisdictions got spoiled, but we're now in for the long haul. One of the things that I wanted to work with the jurisdictions on much more aggressively is we have to have an annual budget. We also have to have a serious discussion about 3 years and 5 years. What should they expect? And then what should they be planning for with that in mind? I can't prove it, but I think we got into part of our trap this year, partly as reduced ridership. Federal transit benefit has hit us hard. Loss of that has hit us hard. But we also were suffering from the fact that last year we raised the fare. And our side of the equation brought in a lot of the money. I think they got kind of a, not a free ride, but they didn't have to kind of match that. This year, we're not raising the fare, and just the, even the normal year-to-year increases in the budget for cost of goods and cost of labor was falling completely on their side at a year when it wasn't acceptable for them to do that. So the more we can look at it multi-year, I think we could do a better job. And we certainly will never give up on the theory that at least some form of dedicated revenue would be helpful. But I don't hold out enormous hope that those things will get there or that they actually will work if we did get them. Yeah. Right.
Kind of following along that, but more broadly, what does the long haul look like to you for WMATA in your new role? I mean, there's a lot of challenges out there, decreased ridership, but also very different way in which people are living in the district and the surrounding areas. That being said, you also have other things like car share and other forms of transportation that are coming up. What, if you can just give sort of a, what does 10 years in the future look like for WMATA, or at least what you kind of envision it, including the role with the federal government?
Yeah, I think we do recognize that people's travel habits and lifestyles are changing. I think it's to our benefit in the sense that using transit is a key part of that for many of these people. We have to see how it fits in, what they use it for, what they're willing to pay. But we're in the early stages of this change. To me, one of the fundamentals that's still there is we have a stewardship responsibility for the system. We need to have a continuous, regular reinvestment. Whatever the system would be good at doing, whatever the travel demands might change towards, it won't work if we don't have a system that is in a state of good repair. So that's always going to be a priority. But I think there's room around the margin to say, how do we do a better job? And I had a conversation with staff earlier this week on the issue of communication. We do a reasonable job of communicating. You know, you can look up and say, when are the trains going to be running this weekend or whatever. I had Symphony ticket Saturday night. I looked it up. I said, if I'm at the Vienna station at 6:20, I'll be able to get the train. I gave myself a couple of minutes margin. I arrived at Vienna station. The train had just arrived, 6:10. I get on the train, a warm place to sit, and I left at 6:20. But that doesn't always work as smoothly as that. And the point I was making to the staff was, in some ways, our weekend riders who are choice riders and who are taking trips that they may not take at other times or maybe not their familiar origin or destination may need more information than our regular riders. You know, when you set out to go to the zoo and you're going to take your kids there and change from the orange line to the red line, it's really important you know that they're both going to be running. And we just may need to – there are good ways to be able to find out, but we have to be sure the information is good because those are the riders who are making real, you know, real decisions of either using Metro or not. And, you know, I try to listen to that. I punish myself daily by scrolling quickly through Twitter and saying, what are people saying about the system? What are they saying about me? And wash my hands afterwards and say, wasn't a good day today. I very seldom respond, although when somebody said very specifically, Moore Townie doesn't ride Metro, I had to take that one off the table and say, you're damn right I do. I'm riding it right now. But, you know, it's just ways to tap into what's going on and think about how we can do a better job. But I do recognize the environment is changing and the region is changing. Dan?
First thing I want to say is before I even knew who you were, I thought you were a really nice guy because at the public participation,
could you hear up?
At the public participation last year, I think for the budget, like the room over there, your guys' room, I really liked the way that you handled the meeting as basically a bunch of people coming up and complaining. or issuing concerns, and I thought you were very, first of all, I thought it was great. I knew you were on the board. I thought it was great that you were there listening to people, and I thought that you treated them very respectfully. It's always challenging not being able to answer any of the questions at the time, but I was impressed by that.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you two procedural questions. The first one is with respect to us being representatives of transit riders. A lot of what we do here, I've been on for about a year and a half, a lot of what we do is dealing with WMATA and figuring out ways to talk to them about things. But I always thought that a role that we could play is somewhat coordinating or at least summarizing ideas or opinions from riders themselves.
Ideas about how we could do that.
Yeah, I was very curious about that because in a lot of cases, you know, we sit down and we're prioritizing some things on our committee and we're thinking about, well, we have a lot of questions and ideas. I'm sure there are a lot of other people out there that would as well that can contribute and then we can sort of carry it on.
Yeah, we did talk last year, whether we actually delivered on it. We talked about some workshops, some potential for outreach. I think we did one on emergency response, but other ways that we could do that, put you out in front of us instead of me, I'd be happy to listen. But how do we encourage people to tell us what we really need to know?
And I
don't need to know that I'm just a bad guy. I know that.
But I think we can. Yeah. I think we can perform a function of sort of organizing that or filtering it in a way.
Happy to explore that.
The other question I have is one of the things that happens commonly with us here is that we don't necessarily have a specific complaint or a concern. We have sort of a general area of questioning. And, you know, to be responsible, instead of sort of passing on a laundry list of accusatory questions to WMATA, we'd much rather be able to say, well, this is an area in which we just like to learn more. You know, not looking for problems, but just to learn more so that, you know, we're not wasting your time with asking questions of things that you already do. So I was just wondering, that's probably an issue that you guys have to deal with on the board itself, and how do you guys handle it, and how do you ask us to handle it? You know, one way is sort of passing on a list of questions. The other way is just maybe having a mechanism where we can just have somebody come in general and just talk to us in general about an area.
Yeah, I think we should explore that. One of the things one has to accept is we'll never be perfect. Never ridden on a transit system that indeed is perfect. There are some that are really good, but even they have some problems. The expectations of most of our riders, correctly so, is we should be perfect, even if it's only for their ride. We'll report Monday. The Inspector General is just finishing up a report on escalators. She may get drummed out of the Inspector General Corps because the report says the escalators are working pretty well, and they're working better than they used to be. And the maintenance approach that's been taken actually paid off. If you fix them, they work better than if you don't fix them. That wasn't the way. The old practice was when they broke down, you went and fixed them, which then consumed all the time in the mechanics, and they never could do the preventive maintenance. So the cycle is working better. But what I also, with all due humility, have to recognize is if 93% of the escalators are working on any given day, which is a fact, that still is basically only 9 out of 10. And how many of us oftentimes encounter at least 10 escalators in the course of a ride or two rides of the day? We're still going to see ones that don't work. But I think that's part of the education of how do we use them better, how do we use the system better, but how do we also recognize that any mechanical system, whether it's trains or cars or whatever, will have its occasional failings. Barbara?
Hey. So one of the things I've been thinking about is just kind of what the best way is to perform our role. I've been around a lot of the committee meetings and in some various presentations over the last couple of years. And I, like with the budget, I heard that I don't know, was it a couple thousand people responded to surveys about the budget?
We did, yeah.
And the staff had the benefit of that information, and they did. They contacted, I don't know, 100 or 200 community organizations and got feedback from them on fare changes versus service changes and so forth. And
the answer to that one was none of the above.
Pardon me?
When we asked them fare versus service, the answer was none of the above.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, we kind of had that too. But so and then every day there are hundreds of comments that come in that go to the staff. You know, so how, I wonder sometimes how we fit in to this, because there's already a lot of information coming from writers.
Yeah.
What's our niche?
Good question. Maybe partly it is to help funnel that through. What should we know? You know, not in the fire hose sense that you've now collected up 100,000 people who hate taking the train, but, you know, kind of relevant things. I'm always impressed. President Obama reads 10 letters every night out of the hundreds of thousands that come into the White House, but it's a way to keep touch. I used to, when I was at DOT, read every letter that came in from members of Congress. Every day. And there were a lot of them. But it's, you know, it is keeping the pulse. And to the extent you can help us do that, that would be good. I think the other thing that really would be helpful to me, you are increasingly sophisticated users. You've had the benefit of briefings. But it would really help when you look at something we've done or you look at a presentation that's been made or some point we're trying to get across and say, you know, I don't understand that at all. And, you know, force us to go back and say, how do we communicate this in a way that at least some of our friends who have some background can understand it? Because if you can't, I am certain that nobody else out there would. So, you know, that kind of a quality control effort on what we're communicating, I think would be very helpful. And I don't mind hearing that we've done something not as well as we could do it.
Plain English, huh?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Plain English, yeah. And some other languages as well, although I'm not fluent in very many of those. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Okay. I know that
so you're talking about the ads that we put on the system and get revenue from. Yeah. There are guidelines in two respects. First of all, let me say it is a very good revenue source, and I'm anxious to see how we do. I think pretty sure we're now out in a new negotiation. I haven't checked recently, but it is wonderful to go out and put your advertising contract out for bid when the market is strong, because they'll always overbid, and then it's their problem if they can't sell the ad space. And we had a situation where the contract 5 years ago had been tendered to a firm in good times, and they were just losing their shirt, but they still had to pay us. Rather than go out in bad times and re-advertise it, we renegotiated and said, well, stay around and pay us what you can. But now that we see the economy strengthening, it is a time to really maximize what we can get. What kind of ads do we get and permit? There are some board guidelines. We don't accept tobacco advertising, and we don't accept alcohol advertising. That's something we could look at again, but it would be, it's been a board decision that that's off limits. I guess we'll have to now in the district decide, will we take weed advertising? But other than that, most anything goes. It's sometimes a difficult choice. We are bound by the First Amendment. So if somebody wants to put up advertising for a political cause, whichever side they're on, that's freedom of speech. We can't say no to that. And as a board, we get some heads up every other month or so in our regular board package. Controversial advertising that will be coming soon on a bus near you. And some of it is nothing that I would want to be associated with. We don't have any choice. That goes up. But at least we know it's coming. What I love in this town, and it's really gone to our benefit, is the issue advertising. Go down to Navy Yard. There's a whole bunch of posters there. Buy our ships.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not kidding. People who want to sell ships to the Navy will take every possible ad space in the Navy Yard station to catch those people from the Navy Shipbuilding Command as they go to work. Same thing on the Hill. Healthcare, pro and con. Another one, I don't quite know who it was speaking to, but Metro Center was totally dominated by ads to, I can't remember now whether to get, Well, Azerbaijan was one, but no, there were some others about dollar bills versus coins. I think the Mint is right in that area, but they were pressing for, I forget which side they were on, more coins or more dollars. But that's a great source of revenue for us, and we encourage that. Okay. I can stay a few minutes. We all want to get home before the snow.
So unless there's